From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Spencer McCall describes his film The Institute as a documentary. And on one level, it is. It's a portrait of this game. Players call it an alternative reality game, and it revolves around this shadowy organization. The game is weird and fascinating. It has passwords and creepy characters and maps that take you all over the public spaces of San Francisco. The creator of the games says it often happens. Players get a little freaked out, not knowing what's real and what isn't. And that's kind of what it's like watching McCall's film. You're not sure what's real, but you're also not sure it matters. Like the game, the story draws you in and you start to relate, and then you're hooked. The film is called The Institute, and today in the program, we're talking about it. We invite you to join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a film that caught our attention at this year's Slam Dance Film Festival. It's a documentary called The Institute. It's a profile of this elaborate game. It's been called an alternative reality game, and it revolves around this mysterious organization called the Jejun Institute. The game is like the film. It's compelling and strange, and it features these cryptic messages and these odd characters, and it takes you all over the public spaces of San Francisco. It also leaves you wondering what's real and what's fiction. Spencer McCall created the film, and next Wednesday is going to be here in Salt Lake to show it. It's part of our Through the Lens series in partnership with the Utah Film Center. You can join us when we show the film next Wednesday, that's July 17th, at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. We'll give you more details about that as we go along. Today we're rebroadcasting our conversation with Spencer McCall. In some ways, the film is as mysterious and confounding as its subject, so I started by asking him what we can and can't talk about.
Well, the kind of elevator pitch that I like to give for the film is that in 1988, there was a girl who went missing. They don't know what happened to her. They don't know if she committed suicide, if she was kidnapped, what. She just went missing. And it was never solved. It was just a completely unsolved case. 20 years later, these cryptic signs started appearing all over San Francisco. She went missing around Coit Tower. And these very cryptic, very mysterious signs started appearing. And a lot of them were, related to her and her disappearance and saying, you know, there's this project going on that is trying to commemorate this girl. But at the same time, there were these flyers for these really bizarre inventions, and they were all leading to the same phone number that that these missing flyers for this girl were leading to.
Yeah.
So a lot of the flyers, were for things like for a time camera that allowed you to take photos through trans time,
right.
Or come visit the Memory to Media Center, where
wow.
we will turn your memories and dreams into media. The Vital Orbit Human Force Field. It was just what are these?
Yeah.
And they all ended up leading back to this this place, this 580 California, which is right in the heart of the financial district in San Francisco, really high rent district. And when you go in there, you take part in an induction, which is really the only way to put it. And it was a lot like being inducted into a Scientology kind of thing. Very creepy. It gave you a video with a history of this organization. And then it said, now you need to help us. You need to basically help us find this girl who's been missing for 20 years.
Yeah.
And so ultimately, 10,000 word of mouth started spreading, and about 10,000 people ended up going to the induction center. Nobody was ever asked for money. Nobody was ever told what this was or who was behind this. But, one kind of clue, people were given clues, and one clue led to another to another.
Yeah.
Ultimately, over 3 years, people were involved in these weird subversive missions.
Yeah. Which we're going to talk about all this, by the
way.
And
cool.
We have clips from the film which reveal all of this. But we're not going to – let me just – I'll say this to people who are listening. We're not going to give everything away. But we're going to say enough because I think there are some big themes in here that I wanted to really kind of work through with you. So let's explain how you came to this.
Sure.
Did you – I know this was in 2008. You find yourself – you're laid off. and you come upon this posting in Craigslist.
Yeah. So I was working for a company that cloned dogs at the time.
Yeah, everything about this story is weird.
I know it is. And nobody believes a lot of it when I try to tell it. But it's true. And you can look up the company. Cloned a lot of dogs. They went bankrupt. I got laid off and was just kind of, trying to make ends meet, kind of doing like video and media. I had, at that point recently graduated from the college that I now kind of work at as well as a industry teacher. But anyway, I went on Craigslist and I saw this post requesting video work to be done. It was very dubious, very weird, very creepy. And so I applied via Craigslist, didn't hear back for months and months. And when I did hear back, they had me come down and kind of I got to see behind the curtain of this organization. And I got to sort of start helping create some of the art that was used in this project. Yeah. But I was never – it was always very need to know. I wasn't told what the project was or how it would be used.
Wow.
I had to sign like NDAs and after a few years of every now and then getting these random projects where, I was paid almost nothing, but they were fun. They were fun to do.
Yeah.
I was sitting there with a hard drive of a lot of – they had ended up giving me a hard drive to pull assets from to make a video.
Yep.
These were kind of like promotional videos or like faux propaganda pieces for the Jejun Institute. Again, I had no idea what they were, how they were being used. But towards the end, I got this hard drive from them. And the hard drive, I started going through it. And it had just hundreds of hours of footage of both archive footage that they had purchased, player participants shooting footage on cell phones and flip cams, and as well as like seminar footage. And I just started kind of looking at it and this story kind of started coming together about what this whole thing was. And, I just thought it was too weird to not explore and to not document. So that's kind of the genesis of how I started.
That's how you got started.
Yeah.
So, you talked about the fact that at this time you would go around and there were these flyers and they all ended up having this telephone number. Let me play what you heard if you called that telephone number.
Sure.
Apparently we don't have – we'll talk about what it is that you hear.
Sure. So you would call these numbers and they were kind of always encouraging you to call from a payphone. I don't know why. That was just part of the experience. And so you'd call and you would hear this very pretty voice of this British woman saying, welcome to the Jejun Institute, located at 580 California Street. And for those dog horses with the spirit to look up and see, a recondite family awaits.
Wait, do you have this memorized?
Kind of. I wish I didn't.
Yeah.
But that was the whole thing is you'd call in and it would say, go to 580 California Street. Yeah. Just go there. And it's like, what? Like this lunatic street flyer that you see, wheat pasted on the side of a wall is telling you to go to this financial district building. It's literally across the street from the Bank of America headquarters. Yeah. So we went. We
yeah.
Went and
well,
it out.
Garland is one of the characters who goes. You follow him here. This is the moment we were listening to there before. This is Garland talking about his first encounter with the Institute.
I kind of didn't know what to think. I at first thought, okay, someone's making these crazy advertisements for something that's almost too impossible to even exist. And they seem to be urging me to visit this physical place. But once I got to 580 California Street, I was kind of intimidated a bit by both the locale and the building. I realized this is downtown financial district. This is a high rent district. This is a place where you have Bank of America. I walked in and asked for the Jejun Institute. The security guard seemed to know what the place was, asked for my ID, had me sign in, gave me a visitor badge, and at that point directed me to the elevators. I get out and see this very normal-looking lobby And I see the receptionist there, who didn't really seem at all like anybody from the website. You know, I wasn't really seeing the name of this company I was looking for. And the receptionist, you know, asked me if she could help me. And I said, yeah, I'm here for the Jejun Institute. And she handed me a key, and that seemed to be that. On one side's a map. On the other side, there's instructions guiding me through the floor I'm on to some location.
So this gives you a sense of how the film sort of draws you in and sort of takes you on this journey. And so we go with Garland, and we go with some of these other people as well who are going through all of this. And you don't have to give away exactly what happens, but at some point, they get involved in this induction ceremony, and it's all related to this mysterious Jejun Institute, which comes, you know, the backstory for this is that it was the early 1960s, and it was designed around this, the concept of this kind of nonsense term, I guess, socio reengineering.
Right.
And I guess it's related to, you know, Dianetics and Est and that whole thing that was going on in those days. That's the takeoff, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. You watch this induction video when you watch this video about the history of this organization, the Jejun Institute, and they talk very much about how the founder of this organization, Octavio Coleman Esquire, was very close with L. Ron Hubbard and other contemporaries of like pop psychology in the 1970s.
Yeah.
And this organization has apparently been around since then. It has satellite offices all over the world, Santiago, Venice. Like it's just all over the place. And that's the whole thing. It's like, how have I never heard of this? We've all heard of Scientology. But it's like maybe something like this exists. This is San Francisco, the birthplace of a lot of new religious movements.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's really there's a level of I would say what's the word verisimilitude
yeah,
to
totally.
It, where it's too legit. It's just too well produced to not seem completely real. It talks about real people, real events that took place in the Bay Area, and
we see images of what might be seminars or something, and
exactly
people going around and doing yeah. things, and like wow,
yeah, it's definitely a trip. It was like that's the best way to put it.
Yeah.
But it was really for a lot of these people who got involved. It was a matter of going down a rabbit hole. And so the documentary tries to kind of do the same thing
yeah.
where it's just the normal world. And then we go down this rabbit hole and into this absolutely insane world where I don't want to get ahead of myself, but you know, you learn about the Jejun Institute. And then immediately after that, you learn that there's another organization
yeah.
that's trying to defeat and destroy the yeah. Jejun Institute.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about, I want to come back to Garland here. Who's going on this trek in the beginning part of the film. And he goes off on this kind of – they send him off on this kind of scavenger hunt, which is an important part about this game, but it's also an important part of the film because this is where we come to see the city.
Yeah.
You know, we see all these interesting places and back alleys and public spaces and parks and all kinds of places. And, you know, and he sees these weird things like that refer to these false prophets and a brick that says elsewhere 1662, all these really weird cryptic messages. And what I love about it and the way Garland talks about it in the film, the Institute, is that it starts to open up his mind. Here's a clip from the Institute.
There were lots of unanswered questions. Who's behind this? Where is it leading? What's the point? And as it started to unfold, more and more things kind of came to light, especially things like new terminology. The word nonchalance was maybe being used in ways that hadn't really seen it used before. I guess I was afraid that at some point I would be marketed to. It'd be like, well, thank you for, you know, going through this thing. Buy Reese's peanut butter cups or something like that, you know. But that never seemed to happen. In fact, the more I pull on threads, the more the lines are really blurred between what I viewed as the insanity I was kind of experiencing and the insanity of the real world. In fact, I would say that a lot of insanity you run into, it's insanity and you can set it over here. But the insanity that I was getting exposed to so much blurred the lines between real insanity and perhaps fake insanity that there was really no distinction. I think my eyes really were opening up, you know, and seeing the world in a different way.
This is kind of what the film is about in a lot of ways, I think, because it really seems to make a person, the people who encounter this weird induction ceremony, who make the phone call, who went down there, they kind of come alive in a way. I mean, there's an inductee who you interview in the film who talks about that she was always looking for clues after that.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's that's what the real strength of this whole project kind of was that it was starting to try to teach people that there was more going on in our world. There is beauty and just amazing things going on in our world. And if you can kind of look up from your cell phone every once in a while or just kind of observe the world around you, you might start finding these clues that actually lead you down a narrative path where you can start discovering more than just discovering the clues of the narrative, you discover parts of the world you live in that you had never before experienced. You know, a lot of times you walk by an alley on your way to work or whatever, and there's no reason to go down that alley. If you see a clue or you see a marking that is familiar to you, maybe you might want to just go check it out. I don't know.
Is this something that resonated with you, this idea of becoming kind of alive to what's going on around you?
No.
Really?
Not really. I did participate. I went to the induction center, and honestly, it was spooky. It was too much.
It wasn't your thing?
It's not that it wasn't my thing. It was just I didn't want to leave the room and then them say – give me a bunch of money for what just happened.
So you're really suspicious.
Really suspicious. You know, we've got a big Scientology headquarters in San Francisco. So again, I just didn't know what this was. And so my wife and I, we did it. And we just kind of gave up. We left. We were it was too dangerous. It was like dangerous, you know. I had never been asked to actually go on a mission. Like, that's something that happens in movies, you know, like you got to go drop the ring in the fire. And I wasn't down. That wasn't something I was interested in. But, you know, a couple days later, I just kept thinking about this and trying to figure out what is this? Like, what is this thing? Who's doing this? Where did the money come from? And that's kind of where I just, more like from a journalistic perspective, I was intrigued. I wanted to discover it, and I wanted to it's maybe a little sacrilegious, but I wanted to give the answers to the people who had them, especially myself. And so that's also kind of it's kind of hypocritical to even make a movie of this, because a big message of what this whole project was about was getting out of the movie theater, you know, going and experiencing the world instead of just taking the world as a spectator sport. This was trying to get you to participate in it. And so turning it into a movie, you know, kind of kills that a little bit. But I wanted that experience to be there of not knowing what was real and what wasn't, and having that be a puzzle in itself. And so in that regards, I wanted to at least have the movie kind of harbor that mood or that attitude.
That's so interesting, because you don't treat the sort of secrets in the game. You're not playing along. You're not treating it as sacred. So I guess in some ways, as a filmmaker, you're not really that worried about saying too much about this, about stripping away the mystery, because that's the whole point of the movie, right? Is to strip away the mystery?
Ultimately, yeah. That's right. It's to answer the question about – excuse my voice. Sorry.
It's going around.
Yeah. cold around here. Yeah, that's kind of the point of the movie, is to solve it, solve the mystery of what is the Institute, what is the Jejun Institute, but at the same time, almost leave these cliffhangers, not just at the end of the movie, but throughout the movie of, you know, would you like to know more, kind of thing? And if so, you are going to have to, you're going to have to take this out of the theater. You're going to have to go explore and look and find more and decide for yourself what's real. And that's maybe personally the biggest thing that I want people to take from the movie. You know, it's a documentary, and documentaries.
You just put some air quotes there. I should mention that because I do think, when we get back from a break, I want to spend more time with this.
Sure.
Is it a documentary? Yes, sure. It is on one level. But on another level, if you're experiencing it, if you're watching it, you wonder a lot.
Yeah.
Spencer McCall, he directed the documentary film The Institute. We spoke with him in January when his documentary showed at the 2013 Slam Dance Film Festival. We're showing The Institute next Wednesday, July 17th, at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. The screening gets underway at 7 o'clock. Seating is first come, first served. We've got more details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation we had with the filmmaker Spencer McCall. This past January at the Slam Dance Film Festival, McCall showed his documentary called The Institute. The film blurs the lines between fiction and reality. It involves this mysterious agency with keys and maps and secret rooms. There are good guys and bad guys and a missing girl. In reality, it's a game that plays out on the streets and the public spaces of San Francisco, but the game no longer exists. But when it did, pretty much everybody who wanted to could play it. McCall will be in Salt Lake City for a Q&A when we show his film, The Institute. That's next week, next Wednesday, July 17th, as part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. The screening will be at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It gets underway at 7 o'clock. We'll give you the details about it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. So let's talk about, I guess as a radio guy, I was really compelled with radio nonchalance. And there's this radio frequency, and this was so elaborate, this game. I loved it. And I want to play an excerpt from what people would have heard, I guess, if they were listening, if you happened to listen to Radio Nonchalance.
Which was actually a pirate radio station.
Yeah, pirate radio station, exactly, which is so great. Here's what you would have heard.
And now, Cryptic Radio brings you The Secret of Nonchalance. What is nonchalance, and who are its hidden followers? This is your announcer, Commander 14, broadcasting for a limited time on this special frequency. Keep tuned for vital information. Follow along as we disclose a world whose secret presence may mean the difference between enlightenment and total incomprehension.
So that's what you would have heard, which is awesome. And then this is where the part of the story that it starts to get deeper, as you say, and that we start to establish now these conflicting forces. At first we encounter this funky, obscure institute that we didn't know existed but seems to be out there. And then now there's this counterforce that comes up. And on one hand, you have this free-flowing divine nonchalance is the term that comes up. And on the other hand, you have the enemy of nonchalance, the man who wants to market and control nonchalance. You know, it's this Octavio Coleman and the Jejun Institute. What is divine nonchalance as you understand it?
So what the what the Jejun Institute is trying to cultivate and try to sell back to the masses is this concept of divine nonchalance. And divine nonchalance is this idea that if you are oblivious to the problems of the world, if you are just in your own headspace, if your head's up in the sky, up in the clouds, you're impervious to being hurt, to danger. And so, of course, you need the Jejune Institute to teach you how to cultivate this this concept of nonchalance. And once you do, once you presumably give them all of your money to figure out how to do it, you will never be heartbroken. You'll never be depressed. You'll never be sad. Nothing will hurt you.
You'll be insulated.
You'll be insulated. There's maybe rumors of some kind of immortality in some way. And that's around the time that you find out that there's another organization called the Elsewhere Public Works Agency. And the Elsewhere Public Works Agency has apparently been battling the Jejune Institute for the last 20 years over the concept of nonchalance, the EPWA as they're called. they want to give nonchalance to the masses. They want it to be free. They want it to be completely accessible by everyone. And the Jejune Institute wants to
control it.
Exactly.
So there's this moment where the Elsewhere Public Works Agency – there's a guy named – one of the great characters in the film is a guy named Gordo. Flamboyant dresser, wonderful sort of – he just seems completely alive and really funky. And he takes part in what I guess is, Spencer McCall, a demonstration – put on ostensibly by the Elsewhere Public Works Agency.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about it, because what's cool about it and what's weird about it is it's like a piece of performance art, and everyone has gathered to have this demonstration. They're not sure exactly what they're demonstrating against. They're not sure what they're supposed to say. They've got signs. They're not entirely sure where they're going.
Right. So that is really where the lines begin to kind of blur.
Yeah.
Gordo, who's just he works at a costume shop by Haight-Ashbury, and he saw this guy putting up these flyers. This was the first time anybody had really seen who was putting these flyers up, and they started talking, and Gordo let this guy know that he was a performer. He did a lot of performance and acting and improv, and this guy took that information and went with it. And so Gordo was told to go down to their offices to dress nicely. Again, air quotes.
right.
To dress nicely. And when he got down there, he was surprised to find about 100 people all carrying anti-Jejune Institute signs. He was given a bullhorn and a bunch of badges and told to, you know, to that – hopefully he had memorized all the chants that they were supposed to do. I mean, Gordo, he rolled with it.
That's what's cool about it. He was totally playing along.
Yeah. And it was like he was the leader of this organization, the Elsewhere Public Works Agency. Not knowing anything about it, it was just lead these people on a march against the Jejune Institute.
He doesn't know who the people are. Doesn't know if they're playing along or if they're part of what sort of he is. That's the other thing that's
right.
Really fascinating about it.
And in fact, it's not really in the film because there wasn't any footage of it because everybody stopped recording. But at one point there was a police presence and Gordo didn't know where – he didn't know if the police were in on it. So he ended up bolting down the street away from the police when they came and asked for permits. And then at the end, after a successful protest of the Jejune Institute, these people gave Gordo a handshake and said, "See you later." And
that was it.
So that was just a very weird day in the life of Gordo and in San Francisco.
Well, and we have to remind people, I think. And this isn't giving too much away, I hope. There's no such thing as the Jejune Institute.
I mean, that's the question.
Right, it's that like, is, right.
That it, like, it was there. There was an institute. There was a room. There were followers. Maybe nonchalance is real. Maybe, you know, I don't know, enlightenment is real. Maybe... That's the question, how do you define the term real is just too simple for what this was, I suppose.
Let's talk about Jeff Hull.
Sure.
He's the creator. He's the guy who first started thinking about this. Let me play a clip from the film. This is Jeff talking about kind of what influenced him, because he wanted the way he talks about it, he loved the idea of play. He loved the idea. There was this park, for example, we talked about, where they had these secret keys and stuff like that. He thought, well, why can't I do this as a grown-up?
Mm-hmm. And why can't I do it outside the park?
Exactly. And that's part of what this is all about, is you can't just confine it. Yeah. He's saying you should be able to do it everywhere. Here's Jeff Hull.
You know, every day I would go to this children's amusement park. It was like literally a rabbit hole that you could fall down into that led you to these, you know, dioramas, or the magic key that you could put into a story box and then it suddenly would be telling you a fairy tale. It was filled with wonder and filled with discovery, and I wanted to know, why is it contained inside the gates of this little park? And then you go out onto the street and all you see is walk, don't walk, no dogs, or this way, or do not enter, or all these rules and lines and restrictions. And I wanted to crack it, and I wanted to open it up. And I think it was this very subconscious influence for me that, you know, there should be this kind of play infused into the architecture of our real world. People would totally willingly accept that there was a Coca-Cola or a McDonald's or a cool cigarette billboard, you know, right outside their home or their schools, but they would be upset by the fact that somebody did a piece of street art there, and that seemed really backwards.
What does Jeff Hull want?
That is a great question. What ultimately happened is Jeff ended up getting a good amount of investment. He put a good amount of his own money in as well into this project. I think initially there might have been some desire to turn it into a business of some kind, but ultimately at the end of the day, they just were focused on the art, and they didn't want to ask people for money. That would have really taken away from the experience. And honestly, had they asked anybody for any money, I don't think anybody would have followed through.
No, I mean that would completely ruin everything, it seems, for some of these people who are interested in it.
Yeah,
don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think he just wanted to give a gift back to the city. At the same time, I think there were some other motives that he had, you know, one of them being maybe to raise awareness about this person who went missing. And so that becomes part of kind of the narrative.
Yeah. Which we won't say too much about.
Sure.
But, you know, I had a question about whether or not you thought – you said, well, this is San Francisco. And I think people have a sort of knowing sense of what you're talking about. This is a very – this is a city that's full of really amazing and eccentric characters. So I wondered, is this game, do you think, is this just a product of San Francisco? Or do you think this could happen in a lot of other places?
I think it could happen in a lot of other places. I think probably it lends itself best to urban environments. But I would love to see what one looks like in a very rural environment. That would be brilliant. Or a deserted island where an X marks the spot or something like that. What the concept really is, I think, at its base is, you know, we have to go to Disneyland. We have to buy the ticket to take the ride. We have to go inside. And once you leave, the magic's gone. That's the magic zone.
Yeah.
So – is there any way to turn our civic spaces into a form of an amusement park or a game or a hunt for clues?
Yeah.
Is there any way to put mystery and ambiguity and suspense into our everyday lives?
And art.
That's – street art's the big, big thing about it, and you heard kind of Jeff talking about it. It really – doesn't make a lot of sense. It's okay for a billboard to show, I don't know, a pretty lady eating a hamburger or something. But, you know, if you do a piece of street art right next to it, it's like, that's graffiti. However, I think that might be changing a little bit. I noticed, like, here in Park City, you've got the Banksy piece and it's got plexiglass all over it.
Yeah.
Like, protecting that. And So, you know, hopefully that's changing a little bit. But the idea that this graffiti or this street art could actually be telling a story, could have been put up by somebody who wants you to actually know more about something, whether it's like history or in this case, these new religious movements. I think that's really attractive. That's really a cool idea that there are these like hobo glyphs, you know, these markings that actually mean something. During the Depression, for instance, the hobo glyphs, you know, you other like forgotten men would mark whether this place is safe, whether the lady will give you food, whether the cops will beat you on the head, where you could get moonshine, that kind of thing. And that was really valuable for a lot of these traveling, you know, Jodes of the country. So I don't know. I think that that kind of plays a big part of this story. And
I heard it put this way. I think in the film, it was a way of kind of reclaiming public space.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And you know, a lot of people kind of look at the financial district of any city. What with the Occupy stuff that went down. And they look at it with some kind of malice or fear or like these are where the robots are working. And so the fact that this game that was saying, no, this part of the city is mine too, I think that was really attractive to a lot of players, a lot of people where it's like, why would I ever – a lot of people – I work at a cafe on – why would I ever go to the financial district? Like what's there for me? And if, you know, this project wasn't there, I don't know if there would be too much for everybody. There's nothing really for me in that area. It's kind of dry. But this was a great opportunity to start exploring. And San Francisco is interesting because the financial district and Chinatown are like the same. They pretty much touch. So this was going in between the two and you were getting this juxtaposition of neighborhoods and worlds. Going in between that was really unique. It was interesting.
Spencer McCall, he directed the documentary film The Institute. We spoke with him in January when his documentary showed at the 2013 Slam Dance Film Festival. We're showing The Institute next Wednesday, July 17th at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. The screening gets underway at 7 o'clock. Seating is first come, first served. We've got more details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with the filmmaker Spencer McCall. We're talking about his documentary, The Institute. We're showing the film next week. That's next Wednesday, July 17th, as part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We'll give you the details about that a little later in the program. So I wanted to ask you about this. The moment, I think, for Jeff, I mean, he figures this is all a bunch of really great, absurd fun. But then he starts to encounter people who are really taking it seriously. Mm-hmm. And they're blurring this line between reality and fiction. And he's pretty alarmed by it. I guess he hadn't really expected it in many ways. And he talks about these phone messages that he would get. Here's one of them from the film The Institute.
I lived in San Francisco for 11 years and had to leave because of gang stalking activities and being surveillanced and monitored and all the frequency manipulation. And it's a really serious thing to have done to somebody. And if you seriously want to go up against them, you need to get a better together than kind of these silly ramblings that honestly don't really make any sense.
So I guess, you know, I guess he didn't really figure that this could be in some way a trigger for kind of people who are unhinged.
Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of the experimental side of this project.
Yeah,
it's like what happens when you take somebody who's like paranoid, delusional or schizophrenic, who's worried that people are coming for them, and then you tell them there are people coming for you who are monitoring you and what happened, what happens there. That's a lot of fun, and it works great for people who get it, who are in on the fun of it. But for some other people, it was terrifying. Yeah, it was definitely scary. It was like, oh my God, everything I thought was real is real.
Yeah. And there are some people with tinfoil on their heads at this demonstration, and I've been doing that for years, so it's all right.
Yeah, exactly. That's the best way to put it. It's like, oh my God, these are my people. There are a lot of really interesting conspiracy theories, not just in the world, but in San Francisco, and this definitely took advantage of some of those.
Yeah.
definitely. This is an emergent new art form. It's a transmedia interactive art form.
Yeah.
And really, the blurring of the lines between your world, your simple, not simple, we all have very complex lives, but I don't want to say ordinary, just your life, this blurring of the lines between your life and this much bigger narrative, this much bigger world is what was really attractive to a lot of people. And not knowing how to perfectly define where you were in the narrative is what people really liked about this whole thing.
Yeah,
and so,
yeah.
Without that, I don't think a lot of people would have again participated. I think all of the pieces were properly in place to get the majority of people really engaged. And some people are more easily engaged than others.
Yeah.
I guess.
Let me talk about two different reactions to it, because you sort of profile this in the film. On one hand, you have a shadowy figure by the name of Organelle.
Mm-hmm.
And he's one of these people who takes it really seriously, seems to be getting it, but by the same token, it takes on a kind of life of its own for him. He takes it seriously in a way that is – I don't know if it's disturbing or not, but it becomes real for him in a way that's so interesting.
Yeah,
talk about him.
Definitely. Organelle is amazing, maybe one of the most fascinating people I've ever spoken to. And the interview that I did with him was ultimately 9 hours long.
Wow.
It was done over a number of days and ended up using only, unfortunately, about five to 10 minutes of it. But he was very adamant that regardless of what the motives were of the people who were putting this whole project together, this was bigger than them. This was bigger than all of us. This was tapping into something that was very, very important and had the ability to really transform the world, the whole planet. And so when he started kind of telling people this, that this wasn't a game, this wasn't just a game, this wasn't an art project, this was a way of living, this was like a philosophy, a lot of people were like, oh, okay, whoa, man, like, all right, I got it. But what's really interesting to me is to kind of realize that at the end, by the end of the film and the project itself, this is kind of without giving too much away, he was more right than a lot of the other participants gave him credit for.
Yeah.
And so
it's
like – it's just kind of interesting that the guy that a lot of people thought was kind of crazy turned out to be
– prescient.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And then there's another figure who – another person who – Kiyomi.
Yeah.
She gets it.
Totally.
She knows she's playing a game, but it becomes something that's really meaningful for her. And this is the thing that I loved about the film is it was meaningful for kind of misfits. You know, these eccentric types, this playground for them.
Yeah.
And they felt a kind of – because they could meet people who were like them, who had the same kinds of inclinations. I want to have you set this clip up for us because she's talking about – how meaningful it was, and where she talks about she feels like the world is missing some spark, and that's what this game does for her.
Yeah.
Set this up for us.
Yeah, sure. So this is Kiyomi, and I have different participants kind of cover different sections of the whole experience, and she's covering the section where the game is starting to wind down and some closure and is starting to be revealed. And she just tells us what the game meant to her. I mean, on top of getting getting phrases from the game tattooed on herself and naming her dog Jejun. She kind of laments the fact that, magic doesn't exist, I suppose you could say. And this was the first time in her life where she got the sense that the world can have magic in it.
The whole concept of Elsewhere has just been really special to me. I always feel like this world is missing something, like there's some spark that I want it to have. And that's why I'm like, that's what I feel like I'm constantly searching for in my everyday life. And the concept of Elsewhere is like, that's it. Like, that's where I want to be. That's where, you know, there's possibility and imagination. I'm sorry. Well, long story short, I got Elsewhere tattooed on myself as kind of a little moment too, but I don't know why I'm crying. Sorry.
That lovely moment in the film, and she really takes it seriously, and you realize it's more than a game in some ways, at least the bigger concept, I think.
Yeah, I've never seen anybody cry playing Monopoly. I'm sure it happens, but maybe not in that way. What was really cool about this whole experience for me or from my perspective, I'm not really too religious myself, and neither are any of the people that we interviewed in the film. And I think some of that comes from, San Francisco, California, kind of secular attitudes are very prevalent. But what was so fantastic for me to witness, and I got maybe a little bit of it myself, is everybody we spoke with is at best agnostic, just generally very secular, and kind of rejecting of organized religion. And then at the same time, though, they started to gather. They started to congregate and come together and follow kind of this philosophy, this concept of nonchalance. And whether you knew it as a game or not, it still ended up meaning a lot to these people. So in the way that maybe at the end of the whole experience, there wasn't anything there. It really wasn't about where you end up, but it was about how to live your life in a really meaningful way. And in maybe the same way that, with religion, you don't really know what's going to end up at the end, lights out. But it can teach you how to live your life in a way that's meaningful to you. And that's what this gave to a lot of people.
Let me play one more clip from the film. This is Jeff Hull, again, the organizer, creator of this. And he talks about let me play it, because he talks about something I want to ask you about.
Sure.
When people first entered the induction center, it made them nervous. It freaked them out a little bit because they didn't know where the fiction was and where the reality was. And that was the tension that we thought was really rich, was really compelling.
So I want to ask you, does the same thing apply for the film?
It does. And that was definitely very intentional. I think something that's kind of peeved me a little bit over the years is this idea that an audience completely knows what they're watching is real and what is not real.
Yeah.
So we have reality television, which is highly scripted.
Yeah, it's not real.
But it's reality television. We have the new genre of like found footage or, home security cameras. And it's actually surprising how many people do think that's real. Paranormal activity is real. Big intention of mine for the movie was to question it. Yeah. Question the movie. Question every movie you watch. Especially documentaries, and don't accept things for face value. You need to ask what's real, and if you aren't, if you're just accepting or dismissing, you're missing out on something very important. So, you know, we watch a movie or we watch – the news is real even though revisions can be made to the news. And movies are fake generally unless they're a documentary. So, you know, I at first I kind of played with the idea of actually just making a movie of the narrative within the game.
Yeah.
And then when I kind of realized that that wouldn't do it the justice that it deserves, I started really looking at documentaries. And what's really attractive about documentaries to me, as long as it's not like a first-person documentary like a Morgan Spurlock or a Michael Moore or something like that, is the audience doesn't need to have somebody to empathize with. The audience can become the protagonist. The audience can be the main character of a documentary. And so this documentary follows a very simple three-act structure. We introduce the situation, and then the second act, we put our characters into a pit. And when I say characters, I'm talking more about the audience. We put them into a place where they need to navigate it themselves to get out and to decide what's real and what's not. So, you know, yeah, it would have been very easy in that second half to say, to explain that situation, but I thought it would be more fun to turn the movie into a puzzle itself.
Spencer McCall, the director of the documentary The Institute, we spoke with him this past January in Park City. He's going to be in Salt Lake City next week when he will show the film as part of our Through the Lens series in partnership with the Utah Film Center. That's Wednesday, July 17th at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. You can learn more about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to the community radio station KPCW in Park City. That's where we were broadcasting our interview in January with Spencer McCall. Program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.